What do the founders of Calm, Planet Organic, Photobox, Moonpig, Shazam, Mumsnet, Last Minute, WeTransfer, Albright, and the School of Life all have in common? They all put their brain first and start their day with Heights. Heights is the smart supplement for brain health and cognitive performance using plant-based natural ingredients designed to help you thrive. Listeners of this show can get 25% off their first month with the code LEADERSHEIGHTS at www.yourheights.com.
Hello, thank you very much for joining us for another week of Secret Lives of Leaders, the podcast bringing you some of the greatest leaders in the UK talking about their entrepreneurial journeys. And today we have no exception. We have the awesome Michael Acton Smith, aka once named the Willy Wonka of entrepreneurs in the UK. He's going to be talking about his journey, which covers a lot of different companies. And anyone that's the same age as me, which is 30, you're going to know his original company, Firebox. You'll probably have been given or gifted yourself one of his famous toys, which was a drinking chess set. And he then goes on to explain the journey from that, the transition into Moshi Monsters with Mind Candy, which was pretty much his legacy for a long period of time. And finally, his journey with most recently Calm. Rich, can you give us some insights that Michael's going to talk about today?
Yeah, so I think what's really interesting about Michael's story is the fact that he's kind of done so many businesses and had successes and failures along the way. He kind of talks about the mental aspect of running a business, and that's kind of linked with his like latest company, as you say, Calm, which is doing super, super well globally, you know, with so many people getting into meditation and things like that. So, yeah, he really kind of tells this story of ups and downs and the emotional roller coaster with it.
I mean, he's been a pretty successful guy. He's got a very public figure in the UK. He's recently moved to San Francisco just because of the growth of Calm. But, you know, he's very real and very honest. And if you want to hear quotes just like,
"There's no point becoming a billionaire if everyone thinks you're a dick,"
then you're in the right place. You've come to the right place and you've listened to the right leader this week.
And he's our second guest, or with an OBE, MBE? Is he MBE?
OBE? I mean, a lot of people have an MBE that we interview. We're the only ones without one. Anyway, should we just crack on?
From Runway East Studios in London, welcome to the Secret Lives of Leaders.
Today's guest is a man who's been described as the tech version of Willy Wonka. From setting up popular e-commerce websites with university friends to extravagant online games, Michael Acton Smith has always had a drive as a maker. His biggest success, Moshi Monsters, grew to over 100 million registered users and expanded to over 150 countries around the world. It's not all been plain sailing, though. His businesses have come within days of missing payroll, and after booming success, Mind Candy has found it challenging reproducing its second hit. More recently, our esteemed guest has focused his attention on raising awareness and building businesses in the mental health space, an area very close to his heart. Without further ado, welcome Michael.
Thank you. Good morning.
So can we start at the beginning? You were born in Marlow in 1974. What was your first day on Earth like? No, I'm just joking. What kind of upbringing did you have?
I had a great upbringing. I was... spent my early years in this lovely sleepy town, Marlow, on the River Thames.
A very beautiful part of the country.
It's a great, great place. Have you been?
I have. Yeah, it's amazing. I always describe it as Britain's Santa Barbara. It's kind of like that.
Haven't heard that one before. But it was great. Very supportive parents, wonderful sister, very kind of encouraging.
Older sister?
No, she's younger. She's
okay.
She's an actress.
Okay.
She's been in EastEnders and Casualty and The Bill and all sorts of other wonderful British hits. I think one of the most important things was having parents that encouraged and put up with all my crazy harebrained ideas. So
What did they do?
Well, for instance, I said I wanted to breed koi carp and started digging up the back garden. And they were like, okay, give it a go. I tried to set up a golf course again in the back garden. And they humoured me with all these silly ideas. I put on a BMX stunt show and advertised it. No one came apart from my mum, who paid the 5p entry fee. So so I think having that kind of very supportive parents was hugely valuable.
What did they do? Are they entrepreneurs?
So my dad taught English and history at an American airbase in the UK. and he was stationed all around the world with the US military. And then his passion has always been books, and that flowed through to me. So before he retired, he was the librarian, which was his big dream. So that was his love of books. And my mum came to England when she was very young from Ireland. She became a nurse, and then she set up her own chiropody practice. So she's quite entrepreneurial.
Okay, so do you think that kind of upbringing specifically impacted you, or can you sort of trace some of your early childhood moments to the first steps towards this journey? Because you've done a lot of different things, and like you say, a lot of them are quite wacky.
Yes, and I think it is. A lot of it does come from, this very positive, this very nurturing, encouraging childhood, where even if I come up with silly ideas that don't work, there's no kind of blame or criticism. It's like, just keep trying. Try again.
So I once heard a story about you selling rocks.
Oh.
And yes. That brings us nicely into the fact that you studied geography at university. Any correlation?
Nice, beautiful segue there.
Yeah, any correlation? it's a natural, it wasn't geology, but it's close. So
the rock idea was another harebrained business concept. Found some rocks in the front garden, sat outside my house, and tried to sell them to passers-by. And it seemed like a great idea because, huge margins, rocks are free. I didn't manage to sell any, and that was quite
disheartening. Did you have some people almost in the throes of being convinced by your sales pitch, or was everyone just walking past thinking, there he is again with his rocks? Day 200, it's really quite sad.
Rock boy.
Were you 25 at this point?
slightly younger. But no, a few friendly neighbours did stop and humour me and have a little chat. But didn't manage to make any sales, sadly.
So why geography?
Well, I didn't really know what I wanted to do when I went to university. I was a bit confused. I knew I wanted to go. I was quite excited.
I guess also on that point, like, why university? I think listening to your story, it actually strikes me as odd that you'd go to university.
Yeah, it just felt like the thing to do. At my school, pretty much everyone was going. And as I said, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So someone told me that geography was only 4 hours a week and it had the best looking girls. And I thought, all right, we'll give this a go.
Sounds a lot like my choice to do art history.
And it was great. But also, I love travel. I love the world. Fascinated by that aspect of it as well. So I loved it.
So what did you learn at university? Like, what sort of transferable skills? Or do you look back on it a little bit like, well, it was fun?
It was fun. I think I was pretty kind of shy when I went to university. And so one of the biggest things was it gave me a little more confidence. I've met some of my best friends at university, Matt Schoen and Tom Boardman and several others. I joined a lot of clubs and societies, everything from the chess club to the go-karting society to debating club. And
so many segues. You're killing me. Okay, well, we'll go with Tom.
Okay.
So you met Tom, who ended up being your co-founder at Firebox at university.
Yes.
So take us through that. So was that sort of co-founder love at first sight? Was it just we're best mates, we experiment on trying some business ideas? How did that all come about?
So we were in the same halls and we kind of met on a chess club night out, very rock and roll. just became sort of partners in crime at university, getting up to lots of adventures, lived together in the second and third year. And then when we left university, I think we both knew that we wanted to do something. We didn't quite know what as entrepreneurs, but we both got sensible jobs for a little while. I thought...
What was a sensible job?
Well, Tom programmed breathalyzers for the police, which is quite cool. He was able to get drunk during the day to calibrate his machines.
That's
so
incredible.
That's quite sensible.
Yeah.
I watched Wall Street and thought the coolest job in the world would be to go and work in an investment bank. And with my red braces and barking orders into phones. And I did that for a little while, or tried to get into that world and just realized it wasn't quite as glamorous as it seemed on TV. We would meet up in the pub and talk about business ideas and eventually came up with one that we loved and quit our jobs. And that was the start of Hotbox.
Take us through Hotbox and then Firebox. I'm going to make a huge assumption that it became clear quite quickly that Hotbox wasn't quite appropriate for a consumer business.
Yes, yeah. Hotbox.
Okay.
We registered hotbox.co.uk because the products were so hot they were bursting out of the box. We were so creative. But hotbox.com was one of the biggest porn sites at the time, so that confusion wasn't ideal. So we changed the name to Firebox. But no, the idea came, I was down, Tom's parents lived in Cardiff, and we were in Cardiff one day, and we went to a bookshop. This is about 1998, I think. And we saw this huge book on the shelf of a Cardiff bookshop called Doing Business on the Internet. And like, we both knew a little bit about the internet. Tom had done an AI and computer science degree, and I was intrigued by it, but it certainly wasn't, you know, mainstream. And we bought this book, we cobbled together our money, and it just blew me away. I like, I've never been so obsessed with one book. It was fascinating. And it was at that point that we thought, right, we've got to do something on this internet thing. It's going to be big. You know, what if we could sell products? And it would be better than having a shop or a catalog. You could update stock quickly. You could have photos and like just it seemed so huge.
And how old were you at this time?
We were sort of early 20s, so yeah, just recently, sort of about a year or so out of university, and that was the start.
So your hit success with Firebox was Drinking Chess, which incidentally I once bought for my friend on his 17th birthday, and no one else got him a present. And he got so wasted, he literally said, "Murray, get the fuck out of my house and take your fucking present with you." Now, consequently, he's never had another present from me ever again. But we always laugh about it. But he did get wrecked off that particular drinking chess. And it really was an amazing present. Like, it was just an amazing, eye-catching conversation piece more than anything. Apart from I was asked to leave with it, which was great because I could re-gift it. So take us through that. Where did that idea come from?
It was great. So that wasn't the initial start to Hotbox/Firebox. We'd started, we didn't really have any money to buy stock. We'd actually needed to raise some cash. So we did some clinical drugs trials in Merthyr Tydfil, where we got paid £400 for a week of being injected with a new anti-migraine drug, and we survived and were able to buy a computer. That's a whole nother story.
And your hair was like, you know, you had a shaved head back then.
Yes,
it's gone completely.
Just changed everything.
Understood.
But so yeah, we didn't really have stock. So what we'd do is we'd list a product on the site, and if anyone bought it, we'd then try and call up the manufacturers or suppliers to buy it and then ship it out to them. So it wasn't the most efficient business. It was also quite difficult to order off our site because there wasn't, you know, all the off-the-shelf e-commerce packages back then. Tom had to build everything. So to order back in the day, you had to find our page to get the order form. You'd print off this page, write in your details with your credit card details, and then fax it to us. And I would receive these faxes. And then in the evening, I would, with our little PDQ banking machine, type in the details, and that was how we would process our, like, about one or two orders a week. So it was very difficult. We almost gave up because just no one knew about us. And then we had the breakthrough where we thought, what if we could make chess more exciting by combining it with alcohol? And the rest is history. The thinking man's drinking game was born.
Yeah, indeed. Just for the benefit of our listeners, how does drinking chess work?
It's just like normal chess, but you replace the pieces with shot glasses. So you have little shots for the pawns, you have square ones for the rooks, and you have a big three-shot worth queen. And then you play as normal. Every time you capture a piece, you have to drink it. So this wonderful inbuilt handicap system. The better you're doing in the game, the more drunk you're getting. So you can make a queen sacrifice and make your opponent so drunk they don't know what they're doing. And it was great. And the big thing we learned from that was the power of story. You know, it was we cobbled together a press release, we put it out there, and the media loved it. It was in we've got in the Sun, we got an FHM and Loaded, and those we realized that was such an amazing way of growing a business. So that was where we started to generate orders and grow.
As a teenage boy and now a 30-year-old boy, I've always been a customer of Firebox, and it's very interesting because that when you're that way inclined as a man, there's always a way or a reason or a stupid excuse as to why you can find some kind of fun present from Firebox. It's just got that kind of variety. It's not very sensible, but it's like the perfect gift machine, that website. My question to you is, what's happened with it? Who's running it now? You haven't been involved in it in a while. You know, on the surface, as a consumer, it looks to be as good as it ever was.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's about 17 years old now, which is quite old for a e-commerce company, and still going strong. So Tom is running it with a another friend of ours called Chris, and got a great team based in Shoreditch. And we've never really done much advertising. It's all been very, very strong word of mouth and sort of PR. And I personally love it. Just love coming up with finding these weird and wonderful products around the world. And great for people buying for themselves, but also wonderful for unusual gifts. So yeah, got a special place in my heart.
Did you ever have like an interest to exit it? Was it always, or was it one of those e-commerce businesses where actually it's like, well, you know what? Like, we're happy. And it's got a great brand.
Yeah,
we've
had a number of conversations over the years, but never kind of quite found the right connection.
Right.
And still going well. I think we'd be open to having conversations, but it just...
So if Jeff Bezos is listening, then...
Cool. Yeah. e-commerce is not easy in the era of Amazon. You've really got to develop your own products, your own brand with big, big margins. Mm. So it's not straightforward selling other people's products, which is why... One of the key areas that Firebox does is tries to come up with new stuff that we develop ourselves.
Yeah.
So again, that's one of the areas I love.
And what's your involvement still? So Tom's running it.
Yeah.
Lovely man.
Tom and Chris.
Tom and Chris is
the MD. So I'm the chairman, still a director, still a shareholder.
Okay.
And pop by every now and then and make sure everyone's all right.
So. Fair enough. And then straight after that, I mean, just looking online, you might have a different story, but just straight after that, you went on to Perplex City.
Yes.
So tell us a bit about Perplex City. Where did that idea come from? What's the big vision and what's the story behind it?
So that was the start of Mind Candy. So Mind Candy's first product was this game called Perplex City, and it was inspired by a book I read when I was young called Masquerade, which was a treasure hunt, and you'd read this book and there'd be clues, stories and pictures to try and find this hidden golden hair. And it just blew my mind. I thought it was such an amazing idea. And so many years later, I thought, wouldn't it be amazing to recreate that in the internet age, where sort of the online community would be the connective tissue, kind of trying to solve all these puzzles we put out there. So that was the start of Perplex City, raised quite a bit of money for it, about $10 million from some fantastic investors. We created a global treasure hunt. We buried a 100,000-pound treasure, and we put clues out all over the place. In real-world locations, we had live meetups. We put clues into newspapers, on dozens of different websites, mobile phone messages, you name it. It was a very, very big, ambitious, complex project.
How long was that going for? I mean, did you raise funding for that? What's the story behind that? Because that is... I mean, mind-blowingly ambitious.
Yeah, so Ray raised about $10 million and had a team of about 20 people.
Okay.
It took about a year and a half to build, and then we launched it around 2005. And it was amazing. It got loads of press. It had a lot of word-of-mouth buzz. But as creative as it was a bit of a commercial disaster, if I'm honest. And I think the biggest thing was that it was just too complicated. You know, it was such a fascinating concept, but there was just too much involved. You had to really commit and dive in deep to play this game, because it wasn't just on one platform. It was a huge multimedia experience, and very few people had the time and the kind of the sort of inclination to dive that deep into it.
And you say that then led into Mushy Monsters.
Yes.
So Mushy Monsters is probably, I mean, until we do this in 2 years and won't be anymore, fortunately, but currently the thing you're best known for. So take us through the story of Mushy Monsters, because that is a true global phenomenon.
Yeah, so as Perplex City was kind of as we realised it wasn't really working, that was a really tough, stressful time.
Can I just ask, just on that, like, what was the trigger for you to realise it wasn't working? Like, how difficult was that? Was it like just a clear day where you were like, you know what, this just isn't working? Or was it a real war of attrition as founders find sometimes, where you just suddenly, it's not sudden at all, you've known it for a long time, you won't accept it? Which of the two?
It was definitely a multi-month process of realising that. And, I wish it could have been a simple thing. But you're constantly, as entrepreneurs, fighting this battle, thinking, if something isn't working, I just need to work harder at it. And, you know, the gold is almost just around the corner. Mm. Or do you think, oh, God, enough is enough. Let's cut losses here and move on to the next thing. So grappled with that for months and months and months. But it was a deep, deep feeling in my gut that was, this just isn't going to click. Best we take the bit of cash we have left and try and roll the dice one more time. And so that's where Mushy blossomed from.
Interesting. So is technically Mushy Monsters part of Perplex City, the company?
So the company was Mind Candy. Perplexity was our first creation.
Understood.
That was our first IP, which we still own. And then Moshi Monsters was our second IP that we developed. And
so how much cash do you have in the bank left at the point of starting Moshi?
We were definitely well under $1 million.
That's amazing.
So, you know, still had a bit of firepower there. But when you've got a team of 20 people and you're burning through cash and hiring helicopters and hosting events all around the world, that goes extremely quickly. Yeah. So we had to make a very tough decision, big layoff, which was very painful for everyone involved. And Moshi just came from this some scribbles I'd been doing in a coffee shop. I'd been inspired by Tamagotchi. I thought that was a wonderfully simple idea. Drew these little monsters and thought, wouldn't it be amazing if we could bring them to life online? What if kids could adopt these monsters and look after them and nurture them and do puzzles with them and go on adventures? And that's how Moshi started.
Do you think you would have been able to get £1 million of funding for that idea if you didn't have £1 million to start developing it? It does sound a bit wacky.
Yeah, it was a little unusual, and we were trying to spark this off sort of 2007, 2008 during the global financial meltdown. Yeah. So trying to raise money for a kind of pet monster project wasn't the easiest thing to do then. So I think it would have been very, very tough, especially coming off the back of something that hadn't worked like Perplexity. So I think it was very fortunate and very, very grateful to my investors at Index and Spark and Accel and a chap called George Robinson, who kind of backed me and said, this is a bit crazy, this is completely different, but go for it, let's see what happens.
So what did happen?
Well, with the small team that were left at Mind Candy.
So how many of you were left at this point?
I think there's about five or six of us.
Okay.
So pretty tiny.
Did you have to move office, like the whole thing?
We kind of trimmed down our office. I think we stayed in the same place.
Okay.
Had a very cheap location in Battersea. And we cobbled together a website. We found an amazing artist in France to draw the monsters. And we put Moshi Monsters live. And the way we were going to monetize it was through these little phone charms that you would buy from retail shops. And inside the packets would be a code that you type into the website to unlock the experience. And about three people bought them. It was a huge failure.
How many did you produce?
I hate to say it, but I think we bought about 40,000 of them.
So right.
Most are still sitting in a warehouse somewhere.
Always learning new lessons about what an MVP is.
Exactly.
Yes,
exactly.
We all go through that.
That was a bit silly, but it was in hindsight, it's just such a stupid thing to do. No one knew this brand. It was really hard to get retailers to take it. Parents didn't know about it. Kids didn't know about it. So then we came up with a brilliant idea of, all right, let's stop worrying about how we're going to make money for this game. Let's just build something that kids are going to love. And start there, make Moshi Monsters completely free. And the day we did that, we went from about, a couple of signups a day. I think it jumped to hundreds of signups the next day.
Oh, wow.
And then we got mentioned on some very random Swedish website, which was run by a lady in Stockholm. And we jumped to 5,000 signups a day. I'm like, oh my God, this is crazy. And then what would happen is every child at a school that would sign up and adopt a monster, the next day we'd see a little burst of activity in that school. And then it would jump to cousins and friends. And it just started growing from crazy from there.
Take us through some of the numbers, because the numbers are absolutely staggering.
Yeah, so pretty slow originally. And the tipping point was sort of around 2009.
So it's 2 years in.
So it was a real grind, be honest. We did have to raise a little bit more money from our investors just to keep the lights on. Towards the end of 2008, very, very difficult. I knew we had something here. The gut feeling was very different to Perplexity. Kids loved it, and it was spreading by word of mouth, but we still hadn't figured out, the monetization. So we then came up in early 2009 with the idea of making it a freemium model, a subscription, £5 a month. Kids could get access to more puzzles, more adventures, just extra content. And I remember the night we put it live, we didn't really know what was going to happen. And within sort of minutes of that paywall going up, we had our first order. And, the whole office was high-fiving each other. And then about 2 minutes later, we had our second one, then our third one. And we went home exhausted that night and came in the next day and had hundreds and hundreds of orders. And we knew then at that point that there was something really amazing going on.
And presumably that kind of growth can't be sustained on the investment you had left. So did you have to go out and raise more? And was it from the same investors?
Well, yes. So the same investors came in and gave us a little bit of money just to test, to see whether the sort of subscription model would work.
Yeah.
But I think we did about 25 grand that first month we put subscription live. It doubled to about 50 the next month, doubled the month after that, and we were at break even really quickly. So
so then you didn't have to raise any more?
We did raise more subsequently, but that was off the back of, you know, unbelievable momentum when
right.
we were signing up one new customer as a second, where it's super profitable and things were really taking off. So the real tipping point was about the summer of 09, where we started complementing all the word of mouth growth with some paid acquisition, and TV was the key channel for Moshi.
And you even ended up having a film.
We did. I mean, that was several years later.
Okay.
But with the key was just realizing that kids love this universe so much, this world, these stories. It was so much more than just a website. They had a deep, deep emotional connection to it, and we realized that what if we could take this love and this passion offline as well?
Mm.
So we did a deal with Penguin. They were our first partner to create Moshi Books. Then we did Moshi Trading Cards, magazine, toys, DS game, a music album that went gold, that was number 4 in the UK charts without any airplay. The magazine was the number 1 best-selling kids magazine. It outsold The Economist and Vogue and FHM.
What, more kids were reading that than The Economist?
Yes.
I can't believe that.
Not many kids read The Economist.
There's a lot about Brexit.
But and the DS game was the number 1 best-selling DS game in the country. It was just, everything just seemed to turn to gold. It was
That's
the most
phenomenal.
Extraordinary journey. And then Universal did a theatrical release movie with us.
What was it like pioneering the company at that point? Can you think back to it? Because obviously you've taken yourself away from that and you're in a different environment now. So just think back to being the founder of, because you're sole founder as well. So the sole founder of that concept with all these people with so much success and such high growth success in such a short period of time. And all the lines you've just, you know, told us about, that is a creative's absolute dream, surely. I mean, you must have been on cloud 9, or was there, you know, a deeper sort of anxiety?
It was mind-blowing. But, you know, when you're in the eye of a storm like that, you don't really pause. You should, but you don't. And kind of stop and think, oh, my God, this is amazing. We've created one of the most exciting new IPs for kids in an incredibly competitive environment. And so I was lucky, you know, I was the initial founder of Mind Candy, but along the journey, who was effectively a co-founder as well, was Davinia Knowles, who was the brilliant yin to my yang. She's an incredible operator and finance brain. And so the two of us were effectively running the show, and that gave me the freedom to do all the creative side of things and the PR and help with the marketing and so forth. And then, we had Toby as our CTO, we had Darren running licensing, we had Ed doing marketing, we had Rebecca looking after the community. It was a very, very strong management team we had. And it just clicked in an amazing way. And
what, you know, I guess like all growth, eventually you hit a peak and, you know, you have to question how to grow again. What were those discussions like, and were they mostly internal? Were they with your investors? Was it, do we attack new territories? Do we create new product lines? Do we create new IP and new titles? What were those sort of decisions? Because, again, a lot of the people that we interview go through a journey, a successful, slow journey of, you know, even Moonpig, you know, it's just like recurring revenue growing each year. There's no major, like, explosion of growth in such a short period of time. I mean, it must be very confusing to know what to focus on next, especially if everything's successful.
Yeah. No, we had a very, very simple strategy. It was a digital heart to the business. So we'd get subscription revenue, which was reasonably predictable and recurring, very, very high margin. So that was great. And then we had around that was the physical products, which was a licensing model predominantly, and both brought in about half our revenue, online and offline. But the online fed into the offline and vice versa. And it was, as I say, just such a powerful model. And we thought it would just continue growing year after year. You know, I think we, at our peak year, we were doing about $80 million in revenue, very, very profitable. And we thought we'd just keep doubling, tripling every year. And then the plan was to use the the cash to start spinning up new IP. And so we had a labs business where we were testing and experimenting with lots of new ideas. But in 2012, we hit a peak, and Moshi in the playgrounds went from being the coolest, hottest thing to not being the coolest and hottest thing. And it was extraordinary. It just caught all of us by surprise how fast that switch can happen. And we, as fast as it grown, it started to come down, and that was terrifying.
Do you like how really interesting things is in a children's market as well? So how do you find out? Like, how do you do the market research about what it is that changes? Do you see what I mean? It's quite a careful, protective area. You can't just go like into a schoolyard and ask why people don't like your product anymore. They don't really understand the importance of why you're asking them the question. So you know, a lot of us go through those ups and downs, but you can always find, you know, run your market research evening with your beer and pizza and find out what it is that's changed that you've done wrong. Like, what did you do in those situations? How did you find out what made it uncool all of a sudden?
Well, I mean, we looked at the data so we could see, you know, sort of all the KPIs were starting to come down, subscriptions were dropping. It was, you know, one of the big things was Moshi had an amazing run. And if you look at most successful kids' IPs, they are quite cyclical. The most successful ones will, and there's very few that you could say have been big forever. You know, you can count them on one hand. And usually the younger end of the market, like Thomas the Tank Engine.
Apart from comic books, probably.
Comic books. Well, yeah, but, you know, that's like a sort of, that's a media rather
than IP. And that's what I'm saying, apart from, yeah, sure, I get what you're saying.
So what normally happens, you know, you look at Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Transformers, they'll have big bursts and then they'll be rested for a few years and they will come back. And I don't think we kind of fully appreciated this. As I say, we thought Moshi would keep going, but it just came down. So kids moved on to new things. Minecraft was emerging around this time. There was the big switch from web, where we were very, very dominant, to mobile. And I think we and a lot of other people thought the transition would be a lot easier than it was. And creating successful IP for kids in the mobile era is extremely difficult. You know, in a universe of millions of apps, most of them free, kids can just bounce between them so quickly, which wasn't the case in sort of web, where there were just a few big web properties like Moshi and Club Penguin and others. So it was a combination of a couple of things that conspired to see this big drop.
Was there ever an interest to exit? I mean, you've got someone like Disney who would have been like perfect. You know, is that ever the idea?
Yeah, so we had a number of discussions. But again, you know, we wanted to build, and some eye-popping numbers were offered. But we wanted to build one of the greatest entertainment companies in the world. We were surfing this extraordinary wave. We thought we could replicate what we did with Moshi very easily with multiple IP. And then, you know, we've learned a tough lesson that's not as easy as it sounds. We rent out, we were trying to raise money at $1 billion valuation at one stage and came pretty close. So yeah, you know, in hindsight, that would have probably been a better thing to do. But it's been a great, unbelievable learning experience, and we still own Moshi.
Yeah.
And Mind Candy is actually doing really well at the moment. We have been through a tough time, 5 rounds of redundancies, some challenging press we've had out there. But we've got an amazing CEO, Ian Chambers, running the company at the moment, and a brilliant team. And Moshi is being sparked back to life at the moment. We have a great new IP called Petlandia. So very excited about where it's going.
Take us through Petlandia then. So what's the vision behind that? And what's the and do you see Mind Candy creating more products like that? Is that the next wave?
Yes. So Mind Candy basically creates worlds that fire the imagination. You know, we've done it several times, Moshi being the biggest, but Petlandia is a new world, a new universe where pets become stars, where, you know, what would happen if dogs became YouTube stars or hamsters were on Snapchat. And we wanted to mix up pop culture with this trend around people wanting their pets to become famous, such as yourself.
Yeah, I can relate.
And Grumpy Cat and all these other pet stars that
Grumpy
are out
Cat
there.
Grumpy Cat is one rich cat.
Oh, it's done amazingly well. Yeah. $60 billion a year are spent in America alone just on pets, and it's an incredible growth market.
Yeah.
So we felt there was something there, and basically what the first product we launched was a book where you can send us, you can create your pet, and we turn it into this beautiful personalized book. And then we're going to be creating a whole host of other products where your pet can be featured on mugs and clothing and you name it. And in your community of friends and family and work colleagues, you can turn your pet into a star.
So as a CEO,
yes,
of the company, as you were, you strike me as a type of CEO who's really the creative director. Is that fair to say? Or did you have a creative director?
Well, so during the growth of Moshi and still at Mindcaddy now, there's an amazing guy I've worked with called Steve Cleverly, who is a musician and a creative genius. And so we kind of riff and bounce off each other extremely well. But during the growth of Moshi, I was CEO and very heavily involved in the creative side of things as well. And that, I think, works when you do have a very, very strong second in command, such as Davinia,
right,
to help sort of all the organizational side of things run smoothly.
And were there like disagreements between the board at any point with like new product development? You know, it's not your typical, you know, I've got a new product idea, it's in exactly the line of what we're doing. You know, they, by their very nature, you hope they're wackier than the next or more niche than the next or whatever it might be. So how do you come to a decision together? That's kind of that thing I'm really interested in, you know. It's so creative.
Yeah.
So well, who's in the decision-making process and how do people agree on things or disagree on things in an environment like that?
I think a healthy board is when you have a strong CEO and a supportive board. The board shouldn't be making these decisions about what IP to launch next. And they've been very supportive to us all along the way. We would come and present new ideas and tell them what we're going to do. And then they would be supportive of that along the way. And I think what we've realized is how challenging it is to be an entertainment company. And it's not just creating games, it's in music, it's in film. You have to roll the dice and cross your fingers, and hits are incredibly rare.
And hiring talent there must be absolutely impossible.
Hiring talent is tough, but you have to build that pipeline of, you know, multiple early stage prototyping, the few that like look promising, you green light and take them to the next stage. Mm. And kind of, putting that all in place has been a big learning experience for us.
So you stepped down as CEO, and you know, what was your reasoning, decision making process from doing that? And did you take time off in between?
Yeah, a little bit. So during the time that Moshi was coming down and we were launching multiple apps and desperately trying to kind of spark the growth again, it was very, very challenging, very, very difficult for several years. Lots of sleepless nights and stress and headaches, and you know, not just me but the whole company. And I took a little bit of time off. I went away, did something I'd never done before, taking a solo holiday, which you know, I've mentioned in my talks before, but I highly recommend for entrepreneurs.
Where did you go?
So I went to a place in Austria called Stanglewort, which...
I swear to God, I genuinely was sitting in my mind thinking, I can't wait for him to name somewhere in India. This is so, be so obvious. And then he was just like, Austria...
It was just a bit random. I love tennis, and they have an amazing tennis camp there. So in the mornings, I'd play a couple of hours of tennis. Then I'd go for a walk in the fresh alpine air, splash around in the streams, pet some goats, and eat healthy food.
How long was this holiday?
This was a week.
Okay.
But I just took a ton of books and research papers, and I'd set up Calm with my buddy Alex Chu a little while earlier, but wasn't heavily involved. Alex was running it over in San Francisco, and I was like the silent co-partner. But I dived deep into this space of meditation and mindfulness. Had been super intrigued, but didn't really understand the neuroscience behind it. And it just blew my mind. A huge light bulb went on. And I realized that, you know, meditation isn't just sitting down and kind of clearing your mind and chilling out. You know, it's not a religious practice. It doesn't have to be spiritual and woo-woo, which I think puts a lot of people off. I realized that it's effectively a really valuable skill of training the mind. It's mental fitness. In the way that we go to the gym to train our bodies and we lift weights, we meditate to train the muscle in our brain to increase our attention, our awareness, and a whole range of other skills that are incredibly valuable in modern life for entrepreneurs and everybody else.
So before we come on to Calm, because as you know, I'm a big user and I love it. Sorry, a big user of Calm. Big user is not something that you want. typical, or symptomatic almost, of a creative is these different businesses in different areas, and there's always some overlap, as there always will be.
Yeah.
So how was that structured from a point of view from like Mind Candy into Calm, for example? Was there some overlap there? Was it like, was there actually full communication? You know what, I'm actually looking at this other thing. Like, how does that work?
So it was sort of over a little period of time. They're all these different businesses are separate entities.
Yeah, of course.
But I think it was just conversations with Davinia and the board, and making sure that I wasn't letting anyone down, and being able to be honest and open about the time being spent on everything. And I think, you know, the needle has managed to be threaded where it works. So I can still, you know, I'm still chairman of Mind Candy, still heavily involved on the creative side, and still absolutely love the business and the team there. But now spending more time on Calm.
So not 100% yet on Calm? Or...
Well, I'm running it with Alex, yeah. And based most of my time out in San Francisco. So that is definitely the majority of my time. And yeah, that business has really started to take off in the last year.
So Calm is, apart from being a passion project and something that actually impacts people's lives in a hugely positive way. And actually, as a matter of fact, tell you, I can't remember if I've actually told you this, but we do 10 minutes of Calm before work. Oh, it's non-compulsory. Fantastic. And only 5 or 6 people come, but that, it starts off just being me and one other colleague, and now there's 6 of us. And of course, there is the whole roll your eyes hippie meditation wanker type thing going on.
Yeah.
But actually, by not engaging in it and just doing it every day, and one person extra coming in and doing it, starts to actually bring people in. So my target is to get all 20, but at the moment 6, and it's a really great way to start the day. So A, thank you. B, the fact behind Calm is it's an incredibly successful business. So we've heard rumors of around $1 million a month. Is that something that's really taken you by surprise? Or because it's obviously a freemium product again.
Yeah, with a tiny team, an amazing team, as I say, based in San Francisco. And the first few years were tough. I think, you know, there was this perception, as you say, around mindfulness and meditation. And I think the wave has definitely kind of become much larger now. You know, you look at the press and the word of mouth. So we're getting thousands and thousands of downloads a day organically. And you know something special is going on when that's happening. And people are very, very happy to pay to see these benefits, such as sleeping better, lowering their blood pressure, improving their emotional intelligence, increasing their joy of life, improving their immune system. Many of these are benefits that are now backed by science and hundreds of research papers a year. So for $60 a year or $12.99 a month that we charge, as I say, people are very prepared and happy to pay for that. So the business is very cash flow positive, growing incredibly quickly, and I think we're onto something amazing. That's not just can be a huge, hopefully multi-billion dollar commercial business, but also, I believe, is improving the world. I know that's a bit of a cliche.
No,
are changing the world.
Yeah, I genuinely believe that as well. Do you ever kick yourself a little bit with it? Just think, like, I can't believe something so simple is so profitable and so accessible and so popular. Because it is extremely simple. As someone who runs a mobile company, the app could not be simpler, and that's its beauty.
Yeah.
And really, it's a content business. It's an audio content business.
Well, I think it is, you know, one of the biggest things I've learned on my many, many year entrepreneurial journey is keep it simple. Often we just overcomplicate things all over the place, and usually the simplest solution is the best. And if you look at some of the most successful companies out there, they do... they started by doing one thing phenomenally well. They didn't try and juggle, and that often happens when an idea doesn't quite work. So then you kind of pivot a little bit and you try this, and suddenly you just build this kludgy, weird mess. And Calm is super, super simple, and I think that is part of its success.
So you've just recently started doing nighttime stories as well.
Sleep stories. Yes.
Tell us about them.
So again, you know, as I say, Calm is more than a meditation app.
Is that under the umbrella of Calm? Sorry.
Yes, yeah, yeah. All part of Calm.
Okay.
So what we're trying to do with Calm is enable people to rediscover this state of calm. You know, it sounds obvious, but most of us in the smartphone age, always on, accelerated culture that we're living in, have forgotten how to be calm. And I think when you are calm, life is better. Your relationships are better. You're a better leader. There are so many of these benefits. So meditation is one very effective way of doing that. But sleeping better is another. And so we launched these sleep stories, which are almost like bedtime tales for grown-ups. We mix music and sound effects and very soothing voices to help lull you into a deep, dreamy sleep every evening.
Have you tried any of the apps that you put on during the evening and they play sort of sounds for you throughout the entire night to keep you sleeping?
Yeah, there are lots out there and many have been very, very successful. Mm. But we wanted to kind of take that to a new level. You know, anecdotally, we've heard from so many people who struggle to sleep. I think there's something like 60 million subscriptions written every year in America for sleep medication. And that's not a good long-term solution to sleep. So we wanted a more natural way of doing it. And I think there's something lovely about a story and a human voice late at night. And again, it helps us transition from what most of us do, which is tap out one final email or do a little bit of social networking. No wonder we can't get to sleep when our brains are still whirring and racing. So it's we see it as this this golden period, this sort of transition between the hustle and bustle of the day and the calm of the nighttime.
A lot of people that you talk to about meditation, who've tried it, who fail, and I'm one of them. I try all the time, and I'm still, you know, I force, like, as a company culture to try and get people to do it with me. I still find it incredibly difficult, and that's after months and months and months. Just, you know, giving people a bit of insight here, do you personally struggle to live some of the values of your own brand sometimes? I mean, you're not perfect, and these are difficult things to do, so... Sorry, you are perfect, and these are difficult things to do. But, you know, take us through, like, actual insight from how difficult you personally find it. You're running a big business. It's exciting. It's high growth. Do you not check your emails before you go to bed? Do you break your own rules?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I wish I could sit here and say I kind of follow every principle. And no, it's a journey. It's a practice. And we get better and better over time. But so, yes, there are days that I forget to meditate. There are days that I'm kind of emailing and on phone calls in the middle of the night. And there are days that I lose my cool and temper. But I definitely have seen a step change from where I were. There was a period during the challenging times where, as I mentioned earlier, just really not sleeping well at all. Had a lot of headaches pretty much constantly. Was just exhausted. The joy of work had just turned into a bit of a dull ache, and that has changed dramatically. So I think what meditation does as you do it more is it just helps smooth out some of those kind of huge ups and downs of life that entrepreneurs feel. The kind of, we're yanked around by our emotions so much, and I think you get a little more equanimity, a little more balance, a little more perspective. Tim Ferriss described it brilliantly. He said that, you know, meditation for him changed life from being almost like a foot soldier in the trenches, where you're just up against it and you're kind of sort of jumping from one thing to the next. And now it's like standing at the back of the battlefield, like a general overseeing everything that's going on and choosing how you spend your time more wisely. I think he's also said that something like 80% of the high performers, the amazing people that come on his show, meditate as part of their practice. So there's definitely something something here in a big way.
Also, a lot of them, including himself, refer a lot on his show to having deep depression. Mm-hmm. And using meditation as a way of getting out of that. And actually, you know, there's a lot of initiatives now which state, you know, there aren't really any cures for depression. So the best thing to do is to prevent it with proactive measures, like you alluded to yourself, training your mind. Have you ever looked back on your journey in the tough times and thought back and been like, shit, I was actually depressed during that period, I just didn't diagnose it? Or were you less British than that and aware of it at the time?
No, so I've, you know, never suffered from depression. I've definitely had, you know, good times and bumpy times, but I've been trying to understand it better. So I've been reading a lot of literature around it. Ruby Wax is incredible. Her journey, well worth reading. Frazzled, her latest book. There's an amazing book by Matt Haig called Reasons to Stay Alive. And, you know, basically, that there are a number of ways to treat it. Medication is one, but not ideal. And there's a whole host of ways. So meditation is not a silver bullet. There's a lot of other ways as well. But I think understanding it is valuable from someone like myself and Alex who run a company, but also from friends and other people who have suffered, to be able to work and support them in the best way. Because obviously the worst thing you could say to someone in that kind of hole, as many people do, is cheer up, you know, just pull yourself together.
Yeah, of course.
It's disastrous. And
yeah, it's not very empathetic.
Yeah. And, you know, we're seeing this more and more now, particularly with entrepreneurs who just the volatility they go through every day, the challenges, the learnings they have to go through. It's no wonder that mental health is a major issue in the entrepreneurial world. So, I think we need to bring this more to the fore. And I think that's slowly happening.
So meditate, don't medicate.
I think that's a good way of putting it. But
Fair enough.
Always consult your doctor first.
Dr. Acton Smith, that is. Okay, so what do you do in your downtime?
Well, I love business and I love creating things so much that kind of sort of is sprinkled across everything that I do.
Do you advise? Do you invest? Do you spend time in other people's businesses?
Yeah, no, I love investing and have a great portfolio of different companies. I love events and hosting. I love bringing people together. So everything from dinners to music festivals. I lived in Soho for many years and did an event called Berwickstock, which was a music festival in my house. So we had bands on the roof and bands in the kitchen and in little cupboards. And that was a lot of fun. I set up Silicon Drinkabout back in the day and the amazing Three Beards took that on. And, you know, the rest is history there. I love playing poker. I think that's an amazing game for entrepreneurs. Wonderful mix of maths and psychology. Tennis is a big passion. Love running, play football. Reading, voracious reader. Like to keep myself busy.
It's a lot of stuff. So, I mean, what, do you find that a lot of that's transferable out in the States as well? So football, for example.
Yes.
Able to play that on the West Coast?
Do you know, I've only played a couple of games of soccer out there. Definitely keen to get more. It's not quite, the whole five-a-side culture isn't as big over there, sadly. No. I'm going to see if I can make it though.
So they say it's lonely at the top. Would you agree with that statement?
It can be, but again, I think it depends how you frame situations. So the great thing about being an entrepreneur is that there are others in your situation and, you know, being part of a community, whether it's Founders or ICE or many of the other entrepreneurial communities is I'd highly recommend, and I think that's super valuable.
You always seem very active in those, actually. So it's clear that you actually like to give as much as you like to get, realistically.
Yeah, but also, you know, it's just because it's fun connecting and chatting to other entrepreneurs and just meeting other people. Human beings are very social creatures, and I think we learn a lot from each other.
It's very true. How would you describe yourself?
I think that's a tough one.
It was designed to be tough. Don't worry.
Very resilient, very, very curious, very kind of sort of open-minded to new ideas and opportunities, love going on adventures, hopefully friendly, grateful. I think that's a great, very valuable sort of practice. Try and whenever I struggle sleeping, I try and think of things that I'm grateful for. And when you do that, there are many things, no matter how tough things are in life.
Is it really difficult for you to focus? Because, again, all these new ideas, you must get so excited. Because you're one of the rare people that can come up with ideas and actually knows that you can make them. People will back them. You know, have a great network. You could turn them into real things. And you must have ideas all the time. So how do you deal with your own mind and calm yourself down, essentially, to say, like, I'm actually happy with what I've got at the moment?
Yeah, no, again, I think meditation is valuable for that, helping you focus and not trying to do a million things at once. I've seen that with many entrepreneurs kind of just running in a million directions, and I definitely used to be more like that. Focus is extremely important. Danny Reimer at Index said years ago that, you know, the main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing. And he's absolutely right.
That's a great quote.
Yeah, that discipline is so important because ideas are not the most valuable thing. Execution is that's far more valuable. The number of people that come up with ideas all over the shop. But in the cold light of day, after you've been banging, sort of throwing around ideas in the pub, the true successors are the people then that sit down and start putting one foot in front of the other and making that thing a reality, even if it takes months and years.
I think in the UK ecosystem specifically, you are looked up to by a lot of people, not just for your success, but actually just for who you are. So who do you look up to?
Well, I love reading business books, and there are many great ones over the years. I think, you know, it's an obvious answer, but for good reason. Richard Branson, I think, is amazing, and I had great joy to spend some time on Necker a few years ago.
What was it like spending time with him? Did it match your expectations? Was it? Or...
Yeah, no, it exceeded them. He, you know, we spent a day wandering around the neighbouring island, Mosquito, and he's very, very playful. He'd be jumping out of bushes. He's very competitive, like myself. So we had
tennis.
Tennis. We had a mini triathlon. He beat me at tennis, and he's in his 60s.
I think it was a city playing chess as well, wasn't it?
We played, yeah, so he beat me at tennis, so then I had to challenge him at chess.
Drinking
chess?
Chess?
No, drinking chess. Straightforward chess, and I managed to narrowly win at chess.
How many hours did that take?
It was a couple of hours.
And okay, that's quite quick, really.
Then,
not too bad.
Then he got the backgammon board out, and we played a couple of games of backgammon, and he beat me at that. So I think if I'd stayed longer, we'd have God knows what else other games we'd have played. But I think he's incredible, and he manages to, you know, this very rare setup where he's been hugely successful. He acknowledges that he hasn't always succeeded, and there's been failures along the way, and he stayed humble and kind of fun and enjoys the journey, which I think is what it's all about.
Yeah, totally.
There are many billionaires out there who are not happy. And I think, that's a really important thing. There's no point becoming a billionaire if everyone thinks you're a dick.
That's the title of the podcast.
I was just looking at you, Rich, before you become rich and famous. Just make sure that you remember these words.
Yeah. Okay, so finally, you must have had loads of good advice along the way. So
you just mentioned one which was absolutely brilliant. Any other wonderful nuggets of advice you've been given that really stuck with you?
I think from my grandmother, you have two ears and one mouth. Use them in that ratio. There's a lot of people we meet in life who just love talking. And I think you gain so much more when you ask questions and kind of try and learn from others.
So be curious.
Be curious, very important. I think, again, learning from my dad, reading. There's so much knowledge in books. I think it's one of the sort of best use of time for knowledge gained is reading. And again, a great quote is, you will become sort of the, in 5 years' time, you will be the mix of the people you meet and the books you've read. And I think that's so true. Hang around people that you like. I know that seems obvious, but so many of us put up with radiators who suck energy and hang around with, drains who suck our energy instead of radiators who build us up and support us. And I think that's an extremely important way of going through life. Glass half full, be positive, give back. Enjoy the journey.
Well, enjoy the journey indeed. That was a lot like going on a roller coaster, and it was very kind of him to take us through the ups and downs of quite a twisty and turny journey, which I've got to say, roller coasters aren't for everyone. They're not exactly for me either, but I'm very, very, very touched and humbled that he'd spend that time sharing some of the insights about what went right and, more to the point, what went wrong. So,
such a good guest. Yeah. He was such a good guest, wasn't he?
And just a lovely man.
Yeah, exactly. Really, really nice person. Very, very down to earth.
And a really good piece of insight as well about drains and radiators. Obviously, you've got a good plumbing experience.
Exactly. Next week, we have another interesting guest, actually.
Well, fortunately, we think all of our guests are interesting.
We do, that's yeah. Otherwise, it's kind of,
we're kind of biased. But yeah, we have the very, very charming Chloe McIntosh, who was the co-founder of Made.com. And it's slightly unusual background for an entrepreneur, and it really shows through with her. So she has that classic issue. She came from an architecture background, and because her co-founder, or the person that believed in her and gave her the money, etc., was obviously the very well-known Brent Hoberman, she got a lot of help along the way and a lot of great mentoring. But because Brent Hoberman is who he is, and because of his network of such other high-profile entrepreneurs, she definitely has a little bit of the imposter syndrome that you hear so much about. So despite all of her incredible success, creativity and brilliance, which shines through the whole time, it's fascinating to hear at the end how she really sees herself and how she still doesn't necessarily feel like a classic entrepreneur. So I thought that was really interesting.
So if you want to listen to that episode, make sure you subscribe to us. We're on iTunes, we're on YouTube, SoundCloud and hopefully Google Play Store soon. So simply go along to any of those and hit subscribe so you make sure you don't miss out on any future episodes. You can also check out our website at secretleaders.com where we have all the episodes where you can download and you can actually view the show notes, and you can email us at hello@secretleaders.com. So until next time, thank you.
Thank you.